first you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who've sacrificed the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores, but because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. You who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play, and with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own Western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for September 15th, 2022. This program examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with truer democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Today's program was initiated by a report that caught our attention in July a few months ago when it was freshly published. Its title is Gilded Giving: How Wealth Inequality Distorts Philanthropy and Imperils Democracy. This report describes the extent of the capture of our charitable sector by the wealthy, the risks that this poses, and how it has been exacerbated by the pandemic and other external factors. As inequality has grown in the United States, our nation's charitable system is in danger of becoming a taxpayer-subsidized platform of private power for the ultra-wealthy. And this poses risks to the independent nonprofit sector and our society as a whole. Our guests today are the two authors of the report, Chuck Collins and Helen Flannery, from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Chuck Collins is an author and senior scholar at the Institute, where he directs the Charity Reform Initiative and co-edits the website inequality.org. His most recent book is The Wealth Hoarders: How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. And back in 2016, he published a popular book, Born on Third Base: The One Percenter Makes a Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. Helen Flannery is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in the program on Inequality and the Common Good, where she directs research for the program's Charity Reform Initiative. Her research focuses on the relationship between philanthropy and inequality, including the policies and practices surrounding charitable mega-giving, private foundations, and donor-advised funds. So let's have a look at how billionaire philanthropy distorts public policy. Chuck Collins, Welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hi, Annie. Hi, Steve. Great to be with you.
And Helen Flannery, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
And I'd like to sort of set the stage with a few facts from this report, Gilded Giving, and then Annie will start with the first question. But this report from a few months ago paints a pretty grim picture of how skewed philanthropy has become in our country. Fewer than half of all U.S. households now give to charity. That was two-thirds just 20 years ago. And the proportion of taxpayers who itemized their charitable giving fell from 25% to just 10% in the last, I guess it's been about 4 years since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 was enacted. That's actually discourages charitable giving, and it took effect in 2018. So philanthropy is becoming increasingly top-heavy. In recent years, charities are receiving shrinking amounts of revenue from donors at lower and middle-income levels, and they are more reliant on large donations from smaller numbers of wealthy donors. And then mega donors are influencing public policy while delaying payment of the taxes needed to support a healthy society. So, let's begin, Annie.
Yeah, maybe we should start out with, well, what does a healthy giving society actually look like? What would that look like, Helen, if we actually had such a thing?
Sure. That's actually a really nice thing to think about. What would the charitable sector look like if it was healthy? I would say it would look like a sector where charities have a broad, diverse, stable base of support from donors at all kinds of income levels, where charities are supported by their donors, but they're not controlled by their donors, and where charitable money is going directly to solve public needs. So that's what I would think a healthy sector would look like.
Yeah, broad-based, and there's some really interesting comments you have in the study about how different what a wealthy person wants to donate for than an ordinary middle-class American. I guess the wealthier people are thinking more in terms of their legacies and things like that.
Exactly. The thing, one of the risks of this top-heavy philanthropy, one of the risks is that wealthy people do give differently than everyone else does. And by and large, they don't give to working charities as much. They tend to give to charitable intermediaries. So they give to things like private foundations, they give to donor-advised funds, and that carries big risks, not only for charities, but also for our society as a whole, because it reduces the amount of money that's actually going to charity.
Yeah, this seems to be the two big villains in your report here are what you just mentioned, the donor advised funds and private foundations. Do you want to tell us what a donor advised fund actually is?
Sure. The donor advised fund is a really good question because beyond a narrow set of pretty wealthy donors, most people don't know what a donor advised fund is or how it works. But a donor advised fund it's often described as a charitable bank account. So it's like a bank account. You donate to the donor advised fund, to the account. You get a tax deduction for that donation. Then the money is held by a sponsoring organization, which manages that money. But you, as the donor, get to retain advisory privileges, which means you get to recommend whatever grants you want to whatever charities you want on whatever schedule you want from that fund. Now, there's several problems with donor advised funds, but two of the biggest are there's no deadline. So there's no requirement whatsoever that that money has to be granted out from the account at all. So you could just let it sit there earning income. The other problem is they're completely opaque. So we don't have any way of knowing whether the money is going out to working charities or if it's going out at all.
You can get a tax write-off for just parking your money in one of these things.
Absolutely.
That's incredible. How new is that?
They actually started in the 60s. They actually started in the 60s, but they didn't really get going until the 90s when big commercial banks like Fidelity Charitable and Charles Schwab and Vanguard started to get on the action. So before then, it was mainly community foundations and large nonprofits that served as the sponsors for these. But in the 90s, big investment banks started to form their own charitable wings that sponsored donor-advised fund accounts, and then it just took off like a rocket.
And so the tax benefits occur at one point in time, and then the benefit to society, who knows if and when it happens?
It could be never.
And it could be never. It could stay parked there indefinitely until these people are gone from the planet. And
exactly.
Incredible.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know you have a number of graphs in your study, too, which are helpful. And of the top seven charities, six are these donor advised funds thingies. You want to talk a little bit about some of those big guys?
Sure. Fidelity Charitable is actually the world's largest charity now. So it surpassed the United Way in 2016, and it never looked back. It's been the number one charity in America, receiving the most donations ever since then. And other commercial donor advised funds have rapidly tried to catch up. So things like the Charles Schwab, Schwab Charitable, Vanguard Charitable, those have rapidly started accumulating donations and are starting to catch up to Fidelity now.
Okay, and then Fidelity, again, is opaque. The public doesn't know where the money goes or if it goes. And the other one you mentioned, was it United Way? What was the other one you mentioned?
Well, United Way used to be the world's largest charity, okay. And that is actually a working charity, but it got supplanted by Fidelity Charitable 6 years ago as the world's largest charity, and it's steadily been dropping in the rankings ever since.
But United Way is traceable. Anybody can look up where the money goes, and we know what they're doing, and the public knows, and you know, society in general knows.
Yeah, this is all really amazing. I just can't believe that we're donating to stuff like this, donating to these people that just are already wealthy and getting wealthier. And not only is this a problem right now the way it is, it's a dynamic. It's getting worse and worse and worse.
Yes, absolutely. It's been the fastest growing charitable sector in the last 20 years, donor advised funds have, and they've actually quadrupled in the last 10 years. So right now they have altogether $160 billion in assets altogether, and they receive $48 billion in contributions a year, which for some perspective is about, it's 15% of total individual giving in the country. So of all the charitable dollars that people give in the country, 15% of it is going into donor advised funds. And for a little perspective on that, things like environment, animal welfare, international relief, they're all in the single digits. So donor advised funds are getting a huge chunk of the charitable pie.
Yeah, another fun fact in here is some of these tax deductions, they're based on assessed value rather than what they would actually sell for in the store.
Yes, this is a huge issue actually for donor advised funds, because what happens is that a donor, if you're a donor who has a highly appreciated asset, like you might have a piece of real estate, or you might have a piece of artwork, like you have a Picasso in your closet that has rapidly accumulated value, you can donate that to the donor advised fund. And the thing is that you can, when you donate it to the fund, you get to take a tax deduction for whatever the assessed value of that piece of property is. So you could say my Picasso was worth $4 million and take a tax deduction based on that assessed value. Then when the charity tries to sell it, if they might not sell it for that much, it could be sold for a lot less. So there's a lot of potential for fuzziness in these sorts of donations.
Embellishment.
If I could just mention, I think Helen is describing this perfectly. The reason why we should kind of be incensed about this is these are our tax dollars at work. I mean, when people talk about philanthropy, they think, oh, this is somebody's private money. They should be able to do what they want. But we, the taxpayer, subsidize this. You know, the donation goes to the private foundation and the donor advised fund. The donor takes the tax break the year they make that donation. But then that money can be warehoused, sitting for your... And here's the thing. For every dollar that a billionaire gives to charity, 74 cents of that dollar is lost tax revenue. We, the taxpayers, are chipping in 74 cents. So the richer you are, the bigger the subsidy. And that's why we have a legitimate public interest. That's why we should be talking about this and be talking about how do we fix it, because it's a huge tax break for the wealthiest people in our society.
Yeah, that's we're being just really knocked around every which way. Helen, did you have something to add to that? You're nodding. You're just.
I agree 100% with what Chuck was saying, and it's sort of like we give the tax deduction. It's like a contract. We the people have granted these tax deductions, and in return, that money is supposed to be going to charities that are funding projects that go towards helping the social good. So it's if a person is giving a charitable donation and that money is not actually coming out to charities working for the social good, it's like they've broken the contract with the American taxpayer.
Some of the changes that you're advocating, I think our listeners will be able to see right away when we talk about what the problems are that we've touched on so far. One, that there should be a time limit on how long they can sit on this money and warehouse it. They should go by the actual sale value rather than an assessed value, and that no fund should be held in perpetuity. That's got to stop. And another thing I know that you've been talking about is distinguishing between charitable actors and then things that are actually for-profit interests, not really charities. Do you want to talk about that last one a little bit? Are there some for-profit interests that are masquerading as charities, would you say?
Well, there's, I would say there's certain things that people do. Like there are certain, especially wealthy tech entrepreneurs, like to do their charitable giving through LLCs. Instead of through charitable foundations or even through donor advised funds. So like Jeff Bezos does this, Mark Zuckerberg does this, where Jeff Bezos got a lot of attention a couple of years ago because he said he was setting aside $10 billion to help fix the environment. And he has indeed given $1 billion of it directly to environmental causes, but the rest of it went into his a limited liability corporation, an LLC. So he is using that to do his charitable giving. And what that means is he doesn't actually have to give that money to charity. He could give it to charity. He could use it to invest in for-profit businesses that he feels are environmentally responsible. He could take it back. So it's becoming increasingly popular for people in the tech industry to do their charitable giving that way.
But he wrote off the $10 billion when he set it aside?
Well, that's the thing. No, if he puts it in a limited liability corporation, he doesn't get to write off the $10 billion. That's the catch. But the advantage he does get is it is even more opaque than giving to charity in other ways. So if you have it in a limited liability corporation, you don't have to tell anyone what you're doing with it or...
Yeah, that's sure
that report on it.
What about that other rich guy, Elon Musk? Does he like those donor advised funds too?
He loves the donor advised funds. He actually gives to donor advised funds in two different ways. So one way is directly. So last year, he actually gave $5.7 billion to a donor advised fund, which at the time, I think still is the largest gift to a donor advised fund ever. So he gives directly that way, but he also gives through his foundation. He gives tens of millions of dollars to his foundation, the Musk Foundation. And the Musk Foundation gives, on average, 80-85% of its grants to donor advised funds. So they've given tens of millions of dollars to donor advised funds at Fidelity and at Vanguard Charitable. So in essence, all of his giving is sort of all funneling towards donor advised funds. He gives a tiny, tiny portion directly to charity, but it tends to be causes that benefit him and his family directly. So like he gives to his children's school, and he gives to a charity his brother started. But in general, the bulk of his giving is either going directly to donor advised funds or going to foundations. And as Chuck pointed out earlier, the key thing to remember about this is that he gets huge tax deductions for doing this. The $5.7 billion that he gave last year was coincidentally exactly 30% of his adjusted gross income, which is the maximum you're allowed to deduct for a gift of stock.
How about that?
Yeah.
So you mentioned a lot about the donor advice funds, and then you mentioned just now about private foundations as well. That's another loophole paradise, right? What's involved in having your own private foundation?
Yes, absolutely. Private foundations are very interesting because there's several ways that they can be used to someone's advantage. First of all, private foundations, unlike donor advised funds, they have actual requirement. They are required to give out 5% of their asset base in grants to charity every year. So that's one thing. That's different. But there are a couple things that can count towards that payout that aren't strictly charitable donations. So gifts to donor advised funds can count towards that payout, even though they're not actually grants to working charities. And you can also count any trustee compensation towards that 5%. So if you sit on the board of your own foundation and you pay yourself a salary for doing that, you can count that as part of your charitable distributions for the year. So that's great. And then another thing you can also do with your private foundation is you can take loans out from it for yourself and use it for whatever you want and then pay it back. Basically, you can define your own terms of when you have to pay it back. So there's a number of ways that you can use foundations to your advantage. The other thing, take a step back. When we write about the risk to society from this type of giving, from giving to foundations or giving to donor advised funds, it carries a lot of risks for society because there's two kinds of risks it poses. One is about money, which is what we've been talking about, where wealthy people are able to get huge tax deductions, even pay themselves salaries, get loans from their charitable institutions. The other part is about power. And the thing of it is that when wealthy donors usurp the power to fix society's problems through philanthropy, whether through foundations or through donor advised funds or even sometimes through direct giving, it means you're taking away the public's power to fix their own problems. It means the wealthy donors get to decide which problems get prioritized, which ones get funded, and it means they even get to decide what the range of possible solutions to the problems is. So we lose our public say over how we address our problems, the big problems facing us. And as Chuck was talking about before, this is all taxpayer subsidized. This is all our money subsidizing this industry. And yet we're letting it be usurped by a group of wealthy donors who are basically using it to fix the problems that they want to.
So they're making the public policy for the ordinary Americans who have a completely different experience.
Exactly.
Or they might not, depending on where they're spending their money, and that's opaque to the public. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And they often can use their foundations very deliberately to set the public agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So they can set they can use their foundations to fund public policy that advances their own personal agendas.
Mm-hmm.
So if they own an oil company, for example, they can fund think tanks that will push climate change denial,
mm-hmm.
and push for public policy that is more favorable to extractive industries and that serves their own personal interests. So that's another way they can use those foundations to serve their personal agendas.
Let me mention to listeners that this is Corporations and Democracy program, and tonight we're discussing how billionaire philanthropy distorts public policy. And our guests are Chuck Collins and Helen Flannery of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and they're the co-authors of a report published in July called Gilded Giving: How Wealth Inequality Distorts Philanthropy and Imperils Democracy.
So we have these big rich people that are doing these mega donuts to these very specialized funds that work for them very well. What about our ordinary working charities that some still exist? I assume they're becoming more and more dependent on these big guys.
Yes, they. This is almost the saddest part of the story to me. Actually, because mega donor giving carries a lot of risks for charities themselves. And every year, there's a lot of press and fanfare about how charitable giving is soaring, is reaching new levels all the time. And yet, the key thing to ask about that is who's giving that money and where is that money going? Because, like we said, the Giving to Donor Advised Fund is now taking up 15% of all individual giving in the United States. Private foundation giving is now taking up another 15% of all charitable giving from individuals, which means that charities, and these are both increasing, these are increasing as the years go by, which means that as mega donors, very wealthy donors, are becoming a larger and larger force in philanthropy, it means that more and more money is diverted away from working charities. They're getting smaller and smaller slices of the charitable pie. The other thing that happens is that it means that they're more vulnerable to the whims of a smaller number of donors. So if one donor changes their mind and doesn't give to you one year, that could be a huge part of your revenue base lost. So all your eggs are kind of in one basket.
Mm-hmm.
And your fundraising is a lot more stable if you can rely on a diverse, broad-based population of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask a few minutes ago, United Way was mentioned. Now, are they growing in general, though? Assumedly, well, not as much as these private founders or the private private. I'm reluctant to call them charities, but anyway, the private organizations. But, United Way was surpassed, but are they still growing, or are they just kind of even these years, or what's their situation, do you know?
I don't know as much about the United Way specifically. They're still getting more and more money each mm-hmm. year. In general, the sector as a whole is growing.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole sector is still growing, but it's not keeping up with inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers are growing. Every year you do see working charities getting technically more dollars,
mm-hmm.
but as of last year, it is not keeping up with inflation. So it's not as robust as it might seem. Yeah.
In a way that the giving by the ultra-wealthy kind of mask this trend, the troubling trend of low- and middle-income people giving less. And we believe that's because people are economically insecure. You know, savings rate is down.
Yes, right.
People are squeezed. So they're just not able to give as much as they'd like. And we're not really talking about that and the dangerous implications of that because the overall pie is growing thanks to the mega donors. But that, as Helen has said, and all of you said, it just poses a peril that our nonprofit sector is so dependent on the ultra-rich and their whims and desires. And the ultra-rich are not going to fund certain things. They're not going to fund organizing and advocacy for a fair tax system. They are not funding organizing to expand worker rights. They have their things that are not in their interest, and so they don't contribute to those kind of things. So that's how it's skewing what gets funded.
Yeah,
it's an unfortunate corollary to the growth of the bigger and bigger funds is how the ordinary citizens are giving less and less.
And I believe looking at the charts, that was true before the whole COVID thing hit.
Definitely.
So it's been going on for 20 years and more, including before the Great Recession of 2009, 10, through there. It began in late 2008.
So exactly. It's even happened ever since Katrina. Basically, Katrina was the last time that donors increased, Hurricane Katrina. After that, donors have not increased. They've only gone down. So that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Let me mention that if any listeners would like to get in on the program here and ask a question or make a comment, the number here is 895-2448. That's in our area code 707, of course, 895-2448.
And, of course, these mega donors, they influence, we were saying, public policy, but politics directly, there's some really outrageous players involved. You give an example is Willis Johnson. And what did he do with his charitable donation?
He's quite a story. Willis Johnson is a billionaire who made his money from CopArt, which is an online vehicle auction house. He, last year or the year before, he donated money from his foundation to the state of South Dakota to pay for them to send their National Guard to guard the border with Mexico. So it's arguably one of the, possibly the only time I know of that someone has used charity to turn our troops, our public troops, into a private mercenary force, basically, to guard the border for his political views. There are others that are, sorry, I didn't mean to cut.
No, go ahead.
There are others that are a lot more insidious than that, possibly. Dick Uline, for example, who is the founder of Uline, which is the warehouse furniture superstore. He has used his foundation to fund groups that are pushing the myth of the big steal, the myth that the election in 2020 was fraudulent, and he's funded at least one group that's classified as an anti-Muslim hate group, all through his foundation, all through charitable giving. So, yes, this is definitely happening.
That's amazing. And we had I can't see everybody out there that's listening on the radio, but on our Zoom, we're all throwing our hands in the air here. Our favorite story of all, though, was this one that just came out, and I guess was uncovered just by luck, or well, not by luck, by some people that were paying great attention, which you wouldn't necessarily read every paper that came out, but it's Attack Philanthropy. The biggest charitable donation of all time just came down. Do you want to talk about Barry Said? Or Side? Barry Side? I'm not sure how you pronounce that. And the
sure.
Leonard Leo Loophole.
Yes. Yes. So what happened was billionaire Barry Side just gave $1.6 billion to a charity called the Marble Freedom Trust, which is, not to get super wonky, but it is not a public service charity. It's a political charity, which means he doesn't get a tax an income tax deduction for his gift, but it is able, that charity is able to do political work. So it's able to do lobbying and pay for campaign ads and work for candidates, that kind of thing. And that charity is run by Leonard Leo, who is a member of the, I think the head, former head of the Federalist Society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and they are, he is pretty much the architect of the move to reshape the Supreme Court in the conservative image. So he's behind a lot of the Supreme Court moves over the last decade or so. And Barry Side gave all of his stock in his company to the Marble Freedom Trust. So it was worth $1.6 billion. He gave all his stock to the nonprofit. And then the company was sold to another company, and Marble Freedom Trust got the proceeds from that sale. So they got the $1.6 billion for that sale. Now, because it's a political charity, like I said, Barry Side didn't get an income tax deduction for it, but he was able to avoid paying capital gains taxes on the sale of that stock. So mm-hmm. normally, if he had sold it himself, he would have had to pay about $400 million in capital gains on that stock. But instead, he gave it to the charity. They don't have to pay it. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge way of extending his reach politically.
I have a quick story to say about this particular situation. And it's, you know, it's about personal ethics or maybe personal guilt, but the I didn't know until I read about this guy Barry Seed and his about his business and the name of the business, and I thought, wait a minute, I recognize that name. Well, I've been touting his product for 15 or more years, and the reason why I want to say, because, you know, back in those days when I was first buying my own computers, you know, and buying electronic stuff, and that particular product, APC, it's the only one product of its kind, what do you call them, power strips and surge protectors, that kind of stuff, that were made somewhere other than China. They're made in the Philippines. Yes. I told my friends, hey, get this brand. They're made in the Philippines, you know. And now I find out this guy, you know, he's, you know, I guess just he got rich, and now he's just after whatever, you know, rich people can do for their own benefit. But... so I was embarrassed. Now I have to look for a new brand.
Well, it's difficult to avoid running afoul of a company CEO that's going to be doing this kind of thing. So you shouldn't feel too bad.
Well, one thing about Barry's Side is he actually calls what he does a tax philanthropy. That's, mm-hmm. It's interesting that he's not trying to do what most of the other donors, mega donors, like to do, which is to kind of dress it up a little bit and greenwash it here and lovely it up a little bit over there. It's just a tax philanthropy.
So once again, for anybody that wants to get in on the conversation, that's 895-2448. And we're talking about the report that came out in a couple of months ago called...
Gilded Giving.
There it is there. Yes. How Wealth Inequality Distorts Philanthropy and Imperils Democracy. We're talking with Chuck Collins and Helen Flannery of the Institute for Policy Studies. And we have an opportunity to talk about something very opposite that occurred and was on the news just yesterday. What can you tell us about Yvon Chouinard and his company Patagonia?
Something good happened.
Kind of in contrast, Yvon Chouinard, whose family owns, it's a private company, Patagonia, the outdoor equipment company, mm-hmm. made this.
Oops, we lost the you. Company we lost you there. He said made the, and then you dropped out.
But you're back now, so just restart that sentence for us.
I can fill in also if you want. Sure. So what happens with, as Chuck was saying, the founder of Patagonia, Yvon Chouinard, just gave all $3 billion of his company away, basically. And 98% of it, his company stock, went to a nonprofit, which will hold the stock, and it will earn all the profits from the company, and then it'll put any excess profits towards fighting climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So this was actually a real good thing that happened, as opposed to the other little plots that we have been talking about. We also have a call. Right?
Yes, so my hat off, my beanie off to Yvonne Chouinard. Yes, that was almost, close to $3 billion, loaned by a collective that will use the all the profits to reinvest in the business to fight climate change. Mm-hmm. Let's take this call here.
Yeah, we got to say one thing nice tonight.
Hello, caller. You're live on the air. What is your first name, and from where are you calling?
Yeah, my first name is Gregory, and we were talking about I run off and into my own memory of how to manage the budget and inflation, and I remember during the war. During the Second World War, under Roosevelt, we had price control, and there was the Office of Price Control, there were constantly people out trying to get Justice Department, or some department was trying to and take care of all the black market people, but they managed, and there was also rationing, the government gave us mills, that's 1/10 of a cent to spend, and it was essentially. We have to support the war effort. We have to have food for our troops. We can't be. No, I think strikes were banned. I think in a government that's not constantly under attack, or a government that's not constantly equally separately divided and. Almost as his own nation or own country, there is the possibility to do ever so much more in terms, and I think given his hands are tied in a great deal, I think Biden's doing a very good job of trying to manage the inflation. Part of it may be his own desires. I don't know if he wants to run again. I can't imagine him wanting to run, but maybe he does. But
well, let's see what our guests have to say then about what Biden can do about some of these suggestions that they're making. Thanks for your call. Bye bye.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity to talk about solutions.
Sure.
Because one of the things, when we wrote Gilded Giving, we wanted to not only talk about top-heavy philanthropy and what we saw happening to the sector, but also the things that we could do about it. That would go towards helping the situation be better. Because there's a whole huge list of things that we could do to make the situation better. And actually, Biden put one of them in his budget proposal. He has a section in his 2023 budget proposal that would say that you can't, if you're a private foundation, you can't count grants to donor advised funds and as part of your payout. So he's actually proposing that in his proposal. That's a nice, tiny little baby step in the right direction.
We
would like to see a lot more. Yeah. So, first and foremost, we need to increase the flow of money from these warehousing vehicles out to working charities. So we need to, there has to be some kind of payout requirement on donor advised funds. That's a huge one. So we would say, for example, any amount that you put into a donor advised fund has to be paid out along with any income earned on it in 3, 4, 5 years from when you put it into the fund. Just some kind of requirement, meaning that that money has to get back out to charity. And along similar lines, we would say raise the payout requirement for private foundations. You could double it from 5% to 10%, and that would mean a lot more gifts going out to charity. So there are definitely things that we could do mm-hmm. that would help the situation.
Well, needless to say, the possibility of any of these things moving forward will depend upon an event coming up on November 8th, is it, I believe? So a few months,
yes.
we'll know what's really possible of these suggestions, exactly. proposals in the 2023 budget.
Is there also is there a legal way to say that corporations are not answerable solely to their stockholders and they can actually refuse to do, it could be fiduciarily responsible to refuse to do something injurious?
That would be fantastic. I don't know. I think that would be great if that could happen.
One thing I would just underscore is these proposals for reform are really popular. We did some polling in July. You know, 82% of the population believe, you know, if you get a tax break, you need to give the money in 2 years, in 5 years.
Some but reasonable time, yeah.
Create a foundation that's going to exist for generations. You know, you took your tax break, move the money. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a common sense support for the kind of reforms that Helen is talking about.
Yeah, I think another thing that you're saying is not only should we rectify a situation that's unfair, since it's our taxpayer money, we have a responsibility to fix it.
So that is exactly right. As Chuck was saying before, we have a vested interest in this working correctly. So we subsidize these tax deductions. And in return, we need to have that money going towards stuff that is going to benefit us, the public.
And then there's the tax system itself. I guess you have some ideas about that.
Absolutely. I mean, in general, what we'd like to see is we'd like to see it basically restored to its earlier progressiveness. I mean, make sure that those who are at the top of the wealth ladder are paying their fair share and that they can't use tax avoidance schemes, of which charitable giving can unfortunately be a part, to get out of paying that fair share. So that is the key, I think, to make sure that those who have the most pay into the system in the proper proportion, and that they can't use tricks to get out of it.
And how would you enforce that? You have some kind of an oversight mechanism in your ponderings here?
Well, that's one thing, is that we would love, the IRS right now is responsible for all of this enforcement. So it's responsible for any shenanigans that happen on the charitable end. But the charitable wing of the IRS is really underfunded, and the IRS itself is woefully underfunded and constantly being beaten down mm-hmm. by critics and people who want to undercut it. So we would say you could have a charity oversight board that was a body that was solely responsible for managing what is going on with philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And it would be responsible for trying to enforce that none of these things happen, that people can't get away with things that go against the spirit and the law of our charitable system.
Mm-hmm. And you also have some ideas about how that would be funded, that oversight entity?
Well, you could levy a wealth tax break up the concentration of massive amounts of wealth at the top of the income ladder, and that would provide a great deal of revenue, which you could use to fund a number of things, including this.
There currently is an excise tax on foundations and on charitable giving institutions. That money just goes into the general pool, but that there's a substantial amount of money there that could fund the oversight functions that Helen is talking about. Wouldn't have to raise tax dollars. It's already you know, a foundation is paying a 1% excise tax, and when they fail to pay out in their fair share, they sometimes have to pay a higher tax or a penalty. So there's plenty of money coming in that could fund the oversight. Wouldn't need to be any kind of new tax to do that.
And then I think you've done some calculations about how reforms would help money-wise the whole country, and it's like billions and billions and billions of dollars that you're projecting, right?
Yes, I don't have the numbers at the tip of my fingers, but yes, it would generate an incredible amount of money even if you just raised the payout of private foundations from 5% to 10%. Mm-hmm. It would raise a tremendous amount of money.
All right, this is sounding good to me here.
Well, the number mentioned in online is that's a few tens of billions of dollars over the first 3 years. I think it is.
I think I have $26 billion in 3 years to go to charities. Yeah. Does that sound right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the country needs it. There's, you know, we deal with so many, you know, homeless problems and just, you know, societal problems that aren't getting the kind of funding to solve those that we did in years past.
And that's the other thing about all of this is we have so many problems we need to address. You know, we have all these climate change, lingering pandemic, housing, jobs, education, you name it. And a lot of these problems, we can't wait decades to address them. And right now, a huge portion of our public dollars are being used to subsidize what a tiny group of mega donors wants to do. And they're being stashed in warehousing vehicles where it's just coming out in little trickle. Mm-hmm. And we need to reform this to make sure that the money gets out to charities where it belongs to address some of these things that need to be solved mm-hmm. now.
Yeah. Well, we talk about the climate issue sometimes here on the program, and it's getting plenty of attention on the air here. Once again, to anyone who'd like to get in a call before I wind up the show, it's 895-2448 is the number here in area code 707, 895-2448.
Yeah, we only have about 6 minutes left, so maybe we should spend a little time on how people can access the study and the other resources that you have. I know, Chuck, you have this wonderful group, inequality.org, that has all kinds of information on a weekly basis, that, you know, a nice reality check that you send out. How do people get on your email list to get that?
Well, it's pretty simple. You can go to inequality.org. You'll see a little sign-up box for a newsletter. Comes every Monday. Comes from me and Rebecca Entrelago, the other co-editor. And we try not to just be bad news. We try to have a sense of humor and show, you know, what people are doing out in the field that's inspiring. And there's a whole section of inequality.org, the website, that's devoted to this charity reform work that Helen has really been a kind of a lead researcher on. And you'll see a bunch of our studies and resources there. And if I might just, you know, add another point, which is, you know, we have all these enormous problems. We have a vibrant, independent nonprofit sector. Some of those organizations are struggling. And we also, you know, charity is never going to be a substitute for a good tax system where the wealthy pay their fair share and we can invest in public investments. So we're not going to solve the housing problem with charity dollars. It's ultimately going to be our tax dollars, you know, investing in affordable housing and the like. But the nonprofit independent sector is a great partner and can also kind of be a laboratory for experimenting and getting things done. So we want a vibrant nonprofit sector, broadly supported, as Helen said at the beginning, broadly supported by lots of people, not just a few mega donors. That's what a healthy system with both fair taxes and a vibrant nonprofit sector, we would be a much healthier society overall.
And then the study itself, where do we find this amazing document?
That is also available on inequality.org. And we also have a fax page which pulls out a lot of the charts, the charts and the graphs, so that if you want a sort of a snapshot of the picture of what's going on in philanthropy, the facts page is also, you can link to from inequality.org.
In a way, the easiest thing to do is just Google Gilded Giving.
Yes.
And you'll find the report both at inequality.org and at the Institute for Policy Studies website.
That reminds me to mention, so this is a follow-up to a report in 2016, is that right? You did the first one?
Yeah, it's a biennial report, so we do it every 2 years. And every 2 years we do it, we try to add new stats and extend our trends and talk about topical issues that are going on at the time.
Okay.
And all the lists of recommendations that you've made, they're all laid out nicely in a format where people can access it and see all of them. There's the donor advice funds and the private foundations and reforms to encourage broad giving, reforms to reverse top-heavy philanthropy. It's very accessible, and then hopefully people will be able to get this and then do something with it. I was encouraged that you said one of these things is actually in Biden's now suggesting putting this forward. It's encouraging to see that there's some action in this direction. So maybe there's some momentum we can jump on here.
If he can get one piece of this into the 2023 budget, then think what he can do for the 2024 budget.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, indeed.
Yes.
So, super. Okay, I was also going to put in a plug for the Institute for Policy Studies. A lot of the information is also on that site. It's ips-dc.org. IPS for Institute for Policy Studies and dash DC for District of Columbia .org. And then you can go in there and, you know, mouse over the our work, and then there's a section for called reports, and the report is right in there also. And also you can look at what work is being done there for in the economic justice section, a particular issue. That's the issue areas part of that website. So either inequality.org or ips-dc.org.
And we don't have much time left. Maybe we could go out on with 1 minute left. The poster boy of some of this is Carl Icahn. Do you want to say what he does with his in 1 minute?
Oh, man. Let's see if I can tell it in 1 minute. So, yes, he took a $100 million loan out from his foundation. He used it to invest in a company, which he then sold for $150 million. So he made a $50 million on the deal. And then he didn't pay the loan back for 15 years, even though he was supposed to pay it back, I think, in 9. So he really is taking the loans from private foundation to an ultimate extreme.
And without interest,
he's
I
the
bet.
Poster boy, yeah.
We got to fix this nice stuff. So. Well, okay. Yep. Thank you to our guests, Helen Flannery and Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies. Yay. And the report, again, was Gilded Giving, How Wealth Inequality Distorts Philanthropy and Imperils Democracy. Thanks for being our guest today and taking that one call, and appreciate your time.
We'll talk to you in 2 years.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on third Tuesdays, 7 to 8 p.m. here on KZYX&Z. The next edition will be on October 20th. And for further information about what you can do about corporate dominance of our democracy, and for an archive of this program, eventually, you can go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org.